Well, I have a confession to make. I've been writing a book, and I've been writing a book on fear. The working title is Scared Withless, and it's about all of the ways that we are manipulated by fear, politically, religiously, in marketing. And it struck me that Halloween and ghosts and goblins would make a good chapter. So there's kind of an epistemological question here about whether I turned the chapter into a sermon or the sermon into a chapter, but it will be in the book under the frissons of fear and folk religion. Halloween and so much of our stuff, use a technical term, around ghosts, goblins, spirits, is really about how we deal with those things that make us uncomfortable. Some months ago, when I was talking about humor in a very serious and non-humorous way, I pointed out that the object of most humor is the trifecta of death, sex, and toilets. Three topics that make us all hideously uncomfortable, and we try to spin away the pain and the fear and the threat by joking about it. And so when we're dealing with holidays and holy days or semi-holy days, such as Halloween, days that go back not simply to our customs here or in England, but as Ray Bradbury, a Unitarian, and Jennifer, also a Unitarian, pointed out, they go back to even pre-human times. That we are born with certain kinds of fears, and death, quite naturally, is one of them. The idea of extinction somehow seems unpleasant in Western society. Extinction is not necessarily unpleasant in other cultures, by the way, where the idea in some of the Asian religions is to escape the wheel of incarnation and finally to get that good night's sleep that Socrates offers as a possibility, the sleep that is dreamless. But most of us would rather hang on and continue. So we have Halloween, which is a way of handling and of teaching children how to deal with those universal fears of death, their own to some extent, of their parents, and of abandonment. And what we do with it is we play with it. We make games of it. And this goes back to things that are really primal in the human experience. You can take the idea of ghosts, of goblins, of the undead, or the not completely dead, and look at it in American culture right now. We have all these zombie movies. What's that about? I mean, there have always been this idea of the undead, and I'll get to the religious roots of that in a moment, but all of the zombie stuff that's going on right now, I'm sure it's metaphorical for something, and in the talk back I hope we get to that. The way that bug-eyed monsters and aliens from Mars, the Red Planet, was a metaphor, an allegory of the Soviet threat. I'm sure zombies are reaching us at some level because we are somehow afraid of not being fully alive, not being fully dead, and that's a really good insight, Hillary. And possibly, maybe, the ghost, the deus ex machina, the ghost in the machine, is that when we're in this virtual world with each other, we are neither quite present to one another nor completely absent. And rather than a sky god keeping track of us, my phone knows exactly where I've been. It knows if you're sleeping. It knows if you're awake. It knows if you've been good or bad. So be good, for goodness sake. Thank you. I appreciate that. The whole... Already walkouts. I'm so sorry. The whole thing... When we do the history of Halloween and All Hallows Eve, we trace it most immediately back to the Celtics, being from Los Angeles, I refuse to say Celtic in a holy environment. The Celtic ideas and primitive ideas, we trace it back even earlier. The idea, when you read the Iliad, you have the ghosts of dead warriors, and they appear as shades, and they hover around the battlefield, waiting for their deaths to be avenged. This is exactly the same motif that shows up in Hamlet. When Hamlet opens on the parapets, there is the ghost of Hamlet's father haunting Elsinore. And the ghost really only appears to Hamlet. It's interesting that this ghost, like so many of my own ghosts, talk to me and not to other people that they should be haunting. Hamlet's father's ghost never appears to Claudius, his murderer, but shows up to Hamlet doing this guilt rap, which is, hey, he killed me. Would you do something about it? And because until he is avenged, his soul can't rest. Macbeth, a little bit different. Banquo's ghost shows up, and not Duncan's, the king's, but Banquo's, and haunts Macbeth and drives Macbeth over the edge and into madness. This is a part of our ancient folklore. It even shows up, and we usually don't think of it this way, in our normal, regular religion. In 2 Maccabees, there are some dead warriors who are spotted by Jewish survivors. And the Jewish survivors know that their warriors are dead because they see them upside down. This came from a, to us, possibly peculiar idea that the world was not really flat, but cylindrical like a can of tennis balls. They didn't have that metaphor back then. And that the living were on the top, naturally standing up the way you're supposed to, and the dead were on the bottom. Australia to some of you. And so naturally, when the dead appeared, they were upside down. What it meant was that they did not accept the finality of death, that it was not simply extinction and it wasn't simply heaven, but there was just something that was going on for them. You see it in the New Testament, in the Gospel of John. The whole Easter narrative. In the Gospel of John, Mary comes to the tomb and it's empty. Jesus appears and says, "Don't touch me because I'm not fully ascended to my Father." That really hints at and bespeaks and reveals an attitude that there is something between being dead and being resurrected or alive, that there is an intermediary stage that either the dead go through, or if you look at it from a psychological perspective, that the living go through as we move our departed from the grave up into our hearts and they find rest. You find reflections of this in modern Jewish mourning rituals, where after a burial, you're not supposed to go back to the grave for a certain amount of time. I would specify the time, but no two branches agree on what the time is, so I'll just leave it unconstitutionally vague. And the explanation is that the souls of the dead need some period between 6 months and 11 months to find peace. If you stay more than 11 months away, you're implying that they were just so difficult that it was going to take them longer than most to find peace. The psychological understanding is mostly that it takes us time to find peace. It takes us to take people from our lives and remove them from the graveyard and put them into our hearts and find a more peaceful chamber of our hearts. But what all of these, at the various levels that we deal with religious metaphor and imagery, do is have an idea of a continuation, an idea that there is something else. And perhaps, like prayer, it's not a question of whether you believe it rationally or whether you just kind of carry it around, and the idea that whether you have immortality through children or through acts or through memory or through the phone calls that keep going on. Johnny Carson said, after death, the hair and the nails continue to grow for 3 days, but the phone calls fall off rapidly. So that it takes time for us to put away the feelings that we have and the memories that we have, and it should. And when we have people who have blessed our lives and it's painful to lose them, we know that we keep them before our eyes. We keep them in our hearts. And as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, most of our ghosts personally are friendly, are nourishing, are the voices of parents, of grandparents, of friends, of family, that don't haunt us but inform us and bless us. Some ideas and some guilt may continue with the past, and there may be some haunting, but we train our children from the beginning to be able to manipulate those ghosts, to be able to do something with them and not be overwhelmed by them. Bruno Bettelheim, in his book Uses of Enchantment, talks about all these terrible stories that we tell our children, these grim tales from Grimm's Tales, and can leave parents sleepless while the children are playing with these ghosts and these goblins. We may have been the only church in the area that had somebody dressed as the devil with a pitchfork walking through this morning, but it's how we desensitize our children from the horrors of not thinking about the things that they're going to think about anyway. There was a wonderful cartoon back in the 50s in the New Yorker, early 50s, and I think I read it in an anthology. I didn't see it in real time. That's just an age reference. Parents are at the door of the nursery saying, "Sweet dreams, sweetheart." And in the thought bubble above the child's cradle are all these ghosts and goblins and monsters, because those are experiences that our children have. There are monsters under the bed, and if you can keep them under the bed, that's cool. There are ghosts that show up, and if you can bribe them with candy to go away, you have got tremendous amount of power, or the beginning of some power for dealing with the natural fears, the natural anxieties. We are in a push-pull relationship with our fears. As a society, we medicate our anxieties into submission, and then we go to scary movies, jump out of airplanes with parachutes, and look for the scariest, twistiest Montagne Russe roller coaster that we can find. And so we love the adrenaline, and we approach, and we withdraw. And all of those things give us some experience in handling them, in as with humor, in taking the anxieties that we have and spinning them back, giving us, if not real control, at least the illusion of control. And that can be enough. Because to me, the real wisdom, and I've talked about this before, I love Halloween. I love going trick-or-treating, first with my kids and now with my grandkids. And I love the costumes. I love the fun that they have. I love the fact that they can break the rules and have all the candy that they want until they're just sick. Now, I didn't do that with our kids. But with the grandkids, it's okay because they're sick in their living room, not in my living room. And that's also a valuable lesson. But I like even more than Halloween, and some of you have heard this before, I love the Day of the Dead. It's in the same tradition, but think about what the difference is. We give our children control by saying, if you give the ghost some candy, it'll go away. Day of the Dead says, y'all come. You're welcome. We're going to make a picnic. We're going to make a feast. We're not going to whistle past the graveyard. We're going to take dinner and we're going to have a picnic in the graveyard because death is a part of life and they are a part of our lives. And whether you understand it in the way that it's normally explained, which is there is a veil between the living and the dead, and that veil sometimes is thick and you can't cross it, and sometimes, like on Halloween, it's very thin and permeable, and the spirits can go across. The idea of inviting them in and really acknowledging our ghosts and making them friendly. And I guess the final and pedantic part that I would add to this is, when I was a child growing up, the Catholic Church always talked about the Heiliger Geist. And the translation of Geist was usually ghost. It's obviously etymologically related. But the development of the ghost culture, and of particularly Casper, the friendly ghost, had an effect on changing the church so that it became the Holy Spirit. It's the same thought, but words have baggage, and words make a difference, and you can understand why you would not want to have as part of your sacrament and the most precious part of your service something that the children were going to picture as from Halloween as opposed to the Bible. So the words make a difference, but the practices across cultures is virtually universal. There are times when we welcome in and acknowledge the ghosts of the past. There are times when we try to learn how to deal with our fears and anxieties that are perfectly natural. Abandonment, loss, death. And Halloween, Day of the Dead, Celtic festivals, all of those things remind us of those hardy perennials that if we try not to think about them, they will indeed haunt us. But when we open the doors to let them in, they can be with us as family members, as friends, with the ability to haunt us sometimes, but more often to nourish us and to give us a sense of connection to each other and to the infinite past from which we come.